Welcome one and welcome all to this, Season 11, Episode 8 of the Ubuntu Podcast. In this episode, we're going to be interviewing David Britton from the Ubuntu server team. We'll also have some command line love, it's a real cracker this week, and we'll go over your feedback. I'm Martin, and joining me this week are Mark.
Hello, hello.
Hello again. And Alan.
Hello.
So, Alan, last time you updated us, you had bought a crusty old ThinkPad.
Do you know what I've gone and done this week?
Go on.
Bought another one. So, I bought a T43, which is an i386, like not 64-bit. Is it 64-bit capable? Maybe. But I've got a 32-bit OS on it that I'm playing with. But arrived in the post this week was an ThinkPad 380 XD, which is a monster.
Not a 380 XD.
Yeah. You may mock, but this thing is a classic. It's just huge. It's really, really thick. It's like two or maybe even four modern laptops stacked on top of each other high. It's huge because it's got an optical drive and a floppy drive and like everything else built in. It's really high up. So, But it shipped with Windows 98, which is
fun.
When you say shipped with, years ago. Do you mean shipped to you with?
Actually, was it Windows 98 or was it I think it might have been Windows 95. No, it was Windows 95. Originally it may well have shipped with 95 or 98, but this one appears to have been used by an employee of Allied Dunbar because because it still has Windows 95 on it, and it's Internet Explorer provided by Allied Dunbar. You know, it's a branded, machine.
I see.
So this guy who owned it at some point in the past probably worked for them. And
I see he used a Palm OS device as well.
He did, yes. I actually took a screen grab of the a photo of it because I couldn't actually take a screen grab because I had no way of getting the screen grab off the machine because I've got no network and I've got no floppy disks and it doesn't have a CD burner. So I've got no way of getting files off of it unless I can send them over infrared. It's got an infrared port.
Amazing.
I could probably plug my Palm TX into
it. Oh, you could as well.
Oh, dear.
Hot sync it.
And hot sync it onto my Palm TX and then hot sync it off over Wi-Fi to another machine.
Just listen to yourself. Just listen to yourself. This all that nonsense we used to go through, that
I know, right?
Dilemma of I've got this data and how do I get it from my computer to somewhere useful?
It has a USB port. It has one 1.0 USB port. But it doesn't have the drivers for anything. So like you plug a USB key in, and it's like, okay, let me get the drivers. No,
this is before they got the hang of the U standing for universal. Then.
Yes.
So there's another unique property of the 380 XD, which is if you have slabs in your back garden and they've cracked, it's cheaper to buy a ThinkPad 380 XD and replace your broken slabs with of those.
Yeah. And you even get a little multicolour ThinkPad logo in the corner. So, everyone's
beautiful.
A winner. Yeah.
Right. Shall we move on to our segment?
Yes.
Yeah. So this week we're joined by David Britton from the Ubuntu server team. Welcome, David.
Hello, thank you very much.
Could you just sort of introduce yourself and explain where you fit into the server team and what you do, sort of day to day, month to month, what are your responsibilities?
Sure. I am the engineering manager of the Ubuntu server team. So I would love to do more day to day things, but most of my day to day is making sure my team is successful and shipping Ubuntu server on time and all those kinds of things.
So what sort of size team are we talking about for Ubuntu server?
We have all in total, there's a few splits in the team around different areas of expertise, but we have all in total about 12 people.
Right. And are you focused, traditionally the Ubuntu server for me was a DVD or a USB key you put in a physical server. These days, it's more like clouding it images and stuff in remote servers that I'm never even going to touch, right?
Yeah, it is a really, it's a really interesting project to work on. It takes the same ideas that that Ubuntu Desktop has around making a very nice set of sane defaults and applies that to the server. And that server image that we all used to install on our, you know, on our machine that we had in a closet that was running without a monitor and we wanted to use just to serve up some files on our network, now is used by, I mean, every major Fortune 500 company in some way or another. And it is the number one operating system in what is called the public cloud space.
So public cloud being like Amazon Cloud, Google, and Azure.
Amazon, Google, and Microsoft Azure are the leaders in that market. Yeah, and the number one OS is Ubuntu. So a lot of people don't know that, but that is what is run out there.
Right. It's the usual, like, you know, everyone's using Linux in some way or another, even if it's like a remote box somewhere, whether it's, you know, checking in with your social network or watching streaming video or something. There's a machine somewhere along the line that's running Ubuntu, right?
Absolutely. Not just Linux, but Ubuntu specifically, which is cool.
Right. So we kind of touched on it there, but Ubuntu server is not like one thing. Like when you download the Ubuntu desktop image, you download one ISO, that's the Ubuntu desktop. But the server is available in sort of different guises. Can you just talk us through the various ways you can consume the Ubuntu server?
Yeah, absolutely. So I like to think of this as kind of moving from what is easiest to download and just play with to, you know, what goes out into production. So there is that ISO that can still be downloaded that you can get from the website. When you click the download link for Ubuntu Server, you'll get that. If you're playing around with Vagrant or Docker or LexD, you know, using virtualization or containers, you will do something like LexD launch Ubuntu Bionic, and that will download a Ubuntu server image and spin that up in a container on your local system. It's the same bits that we ship on the that server ISO, but, you know, without the need to have things like grub installed, tuned for LexD, but the same packages. And then also something similar happens in the cloud. So we have a team that we work with called the Ubuntu Foundations team that is responsible for shipping images all over to different people that consume them. So Amazon gets fresh images every day. Microsoft gets fresh images every day, and every other cloud provider that wants to, you know, work with Ubuntu, they get fresh images when they're ready.
Wow.
So they're all tuned just a little bit different for that cloud to work, you know, with the nuances of booting the different hypervisors that are out there.
Right. And there's a new release coming As we record this, it's next week, but as this goes out, it'll be today. And that's 18.04. And obviously, it's an LTS. So traditionally, we've always said that LTS releases, people tend to be quite sticky on. Is that still the case? And in the cloud, is that different? Are people deploying on 17.10 and they'll move to 18.04 and then 18.10 immediately afterwards? Or are people still really sticky on the LTS stuff?
I think on the desktop, you see this pattern where people want to just have something that works with the LTS. Well, magnify that times 10 and you get what happens in the server space. The usage outside of the LTS is really just for qualifying new things that are going to be coming up in the LTS. So 18.04 is a huge release for us, just like 16.04 was. And we will find that people will not update to any of the interim releases unless they're talking about something that they're just playing with and they're not really that concerned with. For production, they will update from LTS to LTS only.
Right. Or even just throw away their 16.04 machine and spin up a new, like.
Yeah. Right.
New instances.
Right. And that's the typical workflow, right? And it's not doing a do release upgrade at the command line. That's the rarity. The common form is spin up a new workload on a new instance and tear down the old one. just like you said.
And I remember seeing a presentation from Dustin Kirkland earlier in the year where he talked about the size of the images being reduced. Can you talk a little bit about that and why, and what did you rip out? Like, did you get rid of Vim and Nano, and what did you do?
That's part of it. yeah, that is called the minimal image, and that's something that we're going to make a little bit more press about once 18.04 is released, but we've already started sharing a few things. The minimal image is basically all of the things that a human would interact with stripped out of Ubuntu server. So things like Biobu, one of Dustin's favorite things to talk about.
Yeah.
Things like editors. A human interacts with an editor, a machine doesn't. And you know, you can go down the list of different tools and utilities, and if you really start evaluating them, you'll realize that it's there for a human, which we want, yeah. Mm-hmm. But not on a place where a human is likely never to touch.
So one of the nice things about of like a circumstance where it's all going to be like configured from a template and deployed to a cloud system, and things are going to be created and thrown away without a person actually being involved in the process. So you don't need any of this human interaction layer.
Yes, right. And the human will really only be involved if something goes wrong. And so we have one requirement, an SSH server still needs to be running so mm-hmm. that a human can still get in and debug. Yeah. And then there is a single command that you run. I think it's called unminimize. Mm-hmm. If you run unminimize, nice. All of the packages that will need to be, rehydrated in that image will all of a sudden download, and you'll have a regular Ubuntu server experience.
Oh, that's lovely.
Can turn this uncomfortable, constrained environment into your usual comfortable Ubuntu system.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
That's pretty neat. Wow. We should have known about this in advance and made that our command line.
That's brilliant. So one of the other things I've seen tested is a new server installer, because we've had the same curses based server installer, the interactive thing that people run, but there's a new one that's completely different and it looks a lot prettier. I'm not dismissing the original Debian installer, because that's nice and curses is great and all that, but this new one looks so much nicer. What's new in there?
Yeah, the old installer we refer to as the Debian installer, or DI, mm-hmm. yeah. For short, and it comes from Debian, but it's long since forked a long time ago, and it's Ubuntu specific at this point. But the new installer is called Sybiquity. So you're probably familiar, and listeners are probably familiar with Ubiquity, yeah. which is the code name for the desktop installer. So the code name for this one is Sybiquity, starting with an S for server.
Right.
And it is a new, still uses a 2E based interface, so text mode only, not graphical. And it's just designed for that, just like back in the day where we downloaded Ubuntu and installed it into the machine in our closet. Now you can download it with a really fast installer that runs, instead of running in about 20 or 30 minutes, will run in about 2 to 5 minutes from start to finish. And it does this by laying down a disk image instead of installing packages and configuring them during the installation process. So it uses that same disk image I was talking about that we ship for containers and cloud operating systems. It's the same one that's well tested and well proven, which is great.
So you run the Sybiquity installer and it splats an image down on the disk, and then from that point onwards you're off and running and you can install whatever else you need on top.
Yes, right. And it also functions as a live environment, just like the Ubiquity based live image that brings you up to a desktop. You can pop that server Sybiquity based image in, boot up, and you're running in a very comfortable command line interface where you can hit Control Alt F2 and switch over and get a terminal, and all of a sudden you have everything that's available for Ubuntu there ready for you to use in an apt-get install away for anything else. So the live environment really functions well too.
Huh. And so you could use that as like a debugging tool for a...
Yes, right.
Huh. Mm-hmm. Or, making sure the hardware that you've got is going to run your OS.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's superb. One of the other things I heard about is NetPlan, and I've seen it mentioned, but because it doesn't feature on the desktop, I've not touched it. Well, I'm sure it will come to the desktop at some point, but I've heard of it, but I just don't understand what it is. Can you explain it?
NetPlan actually is on the desktop. However, usually on the desktop, you configure through the upper right-hand corner menu. So it's basically disabled. But if you go in and you check in your Etsy NetPlan directory on your 1804 fresh install, you will see a NetPlan configuration that just basically says don't do anything. So the goal of NetPlan is to provide a very comfortable, easy to edit, single file, can be multiple files, but a single file view of your networking, sort of replacing the decades old if up and if down style configuration that was in Etsy network interfaces.
Right.
This replaces that with a nice, easy to read configuration format that doesn't try to be something that goes out and actually configures the networking. That is left to two tools that sit on the back end. One is called Systemd Network. The other one is called Network Manager. And you're probably familiar with Network Manager if you've ever played around with networking on the Ubuntu desktop.
Right.
So NetPlan will take that single, nice, easy-to-read file and render out to what is really kind of a complicated-to-configure back-end configuration format, making it so that the user can just edit that NetPlan file, run something like a command called NetPlan apply, and all of a sudden, everything they said in there is done. So it's a great server experience for sure.
So is this likely to be useful in a server environment where you've got multiple NICs and they've got VLANs and all kinds of other things that I wouldn't normally see on my desktop, right?
Multiple NICs, bridges, bonding, VLANs, anything like that, it should be configurable in NetPlan, as well as if you switch over to the desktop side. Say you had some kind of an installation, you didn't want people reconfiguring their network through that upper right hand corner menu. You could use this to configure a fleet of desktops with a single network configuration file, including wireless configuration, VPNs, other things that are kind of unique to a desktop. Yes.
Sweet.
Cool. So a while ago, we heard about LivePatch, and this is a service where you can keep your kernel running whilst you apply kernel updates. So what's changing or new or different with LivePatch in 1804?
LivePatch. I think the thing that's changing is it is a service like most other server-centric services that are only applying to LTSs. So 1604 was the last thing where LivePatch was enabled for, and of course we've been releasing live patches on 1604 for a long time. Well, now 1804 is rolling around, and so we're adding another target for LivePatch. Mm-hmm. And LivePatch is something that is included in our Ubuntu Advantage product, which is a support and service offering from Canonical. However, LivePatch is kind of unique in that portfolio, in that it's available for free for anybody who wants to try it on up to 3 machines. So all you have to do is go to ubuntu.com/livepatch and you can sign up your machine to receive kernel updates without rebooting, which is pretty neat.
So for someone who's like trying this stuff out as a home user, and maybe they've got their like Dell laptop and a home server and maybe a desktop, they could run it live patch on all 3 of those, and you set it up on each one, sign into the live patch, and that's it. You don't have to worry about it. It just live patches your kernels as and when.
That's right. And if you log in interactively to your system, you'll see kind of in the motd, like a little brief status of what your live patch status is, sort of like you see updates when you log in interactively. And there's also some things that you'll be seeing in the in the Ubuntu desktop that kind of gives you sort of like how Update Manager says that you need to update packages. There's things coming in 18.04 that will reference live patches in that same way.
And am I right in saying like it's not a panacea? It won't live patch. There's not every single kernel patch will come as a live patch, and you never ever need to restart your system, right?
Correct.
It's only some certain specific types that are applicable with live patch.
It is the vast majority of what are called critical and serious. Maybe it's high and medium. I don't remember what the security levels are, but the top two levels of security vulnerabilities. It is the vast majority of those. However, something came along like the Spectre and Meltdown. Spectre and Meltdown
disaster. Should we call them a disaster?
Nuclear explosion, whatever that was, where huge swaths of the kernel needed to have patches applied. It would have been too much for a live patch to work in that situation. But that's very few and far between where that happens.
Right.
Yeah. Now, some other buzzwords that I see on presentations and what have you are ESM and FIPS. Can you just touch on what ESM and FIPS are?
Yes. ESM, this fits into the Ubuntu Advantage portfolio of products. ESM is a cool new thing that Canonical is doing to extend the life of the LTSs. Remember that the LTSs are the important thing in the server world. Mm-hmm. And there's still a lot of people out there running 1204, precise was the code name.
Wow.
And ESM is providing patches, security patches, on 1204 for people that pay Canonical past the end of what was, published as the end of life. So every LTS comes out with a 5-year guarantee of lifespan from Canonical, and ESM extends that for people who are willing to sign up for Ubuntu Advantage. So we're going to be extending that same thing for Trusty, Xenial, and Bionic.
So for the, some people would say, well, that's ludicrous. Why would you give Canonical money when you could just upgrade your system? Why don't you just upgrade from 1204 to 1404? Just do it, man. Like, is that a completely ridiculous, as someone who's not a server guy, is that a ludicrous suggestion to make?
That is absolutely what people should be doing, and we would not want to discourage them from doing that. Right. However, you have very large industries that don't have professional software developers working for them. They just maybe have outsourced this, and they have an application that's running, and it's targeted to run only on 1204, and it would cost a lot of money to upgrade that kind of old application. So it's just easier to keep it running, really. And they have customers that use it and they like it, and that's fine.
Wow. That's amazing. So what's FIPS?
And FIPS is another thing for large enterprises. FIPS is a standardization that is meant to be a government established, here is what it means to have a secure Linux operating system. So certain certifications on the way that SSH is configured, on the way that what exact versions of libraries you have installed. And in order to run in some, in the United States, it would be in some DoD applications. In other countries, it would be maybe entire banking sectors would need to run a Linux operating system in FIPS mode.
It's a standard sort of regulatory compliance.
Yeah.
Right. Standards. Okay.
Well, David, thank you very much for joining us and going through all of that. I think we're all learned an awful lot
today.
And I hope
probably
our listeners
more than you wanted to
have
learn.
As well.
Yeah. It's fantastic.
Yeah. I'm sure we'll get you on again at some point in the future, because it will be interesting to find out how the server is evolving over the next few interim releases and what building up to what will be 2004. So thank you for joining us, and we'll look forward to speaking to you again in the future.
Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
If you love the command line as much as we do, send us a command that will blow our minds, and we might even mention it on the show. Send your command line love to show@ubuntupodcast.org.
Right, prepare to have your mind blown. Here is the command line love for this week.
This better be good.
Oh, this is the best thing ever. This week's command line love is pastebinit. And it's a means to send anything you want directly to pastebin from the command line.
Ah, this isn't a pastebin-based init system, then.
It's a replacement for systemd.
Wow, can you imagine? Can you imagine that, like a crowdsourced init system? Right, so no, the way that this works is, for example, there is pastebin. Everyone's probably heard of the pastebin website. But a number of distributions also have like paste.distroname.com or .org or whatever. So the way this works is you apt install pastebinit, and then if you're collecting some debug data, maybe you're on a server, just as we've discussed with David there, and it's not got a browser or anything, you can just pipe your debug information and pipe it into pastebinit, and it will splat it into paste.ubuntu.com and tell you the URL that that paste has been submitted to, and then you can share that. And I found this invaluable in the week working with a partner who needed some debug doing, and they were on the end of a phone and we weren't able to see their shell. So we were sending them the commands we wanted to run in a text chat, and then they were just sending us back URLs to pastebinit, and we had them, you know, dumping all of their debug logs into pastebin. It's extremely useful.
Yeah, it's worth noting you're basically sending whatever you give to pastebinit publicly to, by default on Ubuntu, the Ubuntu pastebin.
Yes, you can change that to another one. And you can also provide the minus P flag, which turns on a private paste.
Does it? Oh, that's good.
Yeah, and there's a few others in there. So you can also you can set a config file in your home directory. This is in the man page, man pastebinit. So you can define, you know, who the author is. So, you know, when you paste something out, has your name in the pastebin thing, and you can make things private or you can make them authenticated as well. So there's a whole bunch of things you can do.
I had no idea about all those options, and I've used pastebinit for years, and it never struck me as something we should talk about on Command Line Love. But actually, the its utility is like, it's just one of those things you forget. It's almost like LS. It's one of the things you just rattle off all the time. It's brilliant.
Yep.
So, yes, cracking Command Line Love.
We love getting your feedback. If you've got a comment about something you hear on the show, why don't you drop us an email on show@ubuntupodcast.org.
And you've guessed it, it is now time for all your wonderful feedback. Andrew Hazen posted in our Telegram channel, ubuntupodcast.org/telegram.
As DNSs were discussed in the podcast, has anyone tried 9.9.9.9 from quad9.net? Seems to be advocating privacy as well, and is done in collaboration by IBM, Global Cyber Alliance, etc.
Nine.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Yeah.
Well done.
Do you like that?
Yeah.
No, I had, I'd never heard of this. Have you heard of this?
Nope.
Nope.
Well, there we go. So you now got all the ones, all the eights, and all the nines. Brilliant.
Just have to write to Xerox and get them to give up all the fives.
Daniel 66666 posted a comment on our website.
Right, did he? Because I can't see the text.
Ah, that's awkward. Yes, I wonder where that disappeared to.
I'll go find it. You move on to the next one.
We'll find that later. So Joe Spurlock emailed us at show@ubuntupodcast.org.
I've heard a few times Alan mention his affinity for DDWRT and the like.
Oh, yes.
So in this spirit, I wanted to mention my preferred home router distro, Untangle, and specifically mention it's also something you can flash onto aftermarket routers. And he gives a link to the website there where you can download it.
So it's untangle.com, and they've got various products there. I remember this from some years ago. Mm. I think that they were a sponsor of another Linux-related podcast in the past, and that's how I'd heard of them, and I'd taken a look, and... if memory serves, it produces a web interface that looks like a rack, and you can put these virtual appliances in the rack.
Oh, like one of those like jack audio processors where you can make a load
and
of
then
guitar effects.
Connect things up and configure the switch and configure
That's
the firewall.
Cool.
Yeah.
I So I did have DDWRT, and then I switched to OpenWRT, and then I switched to Lead because apparently OpenWRT was dying and Lead was better. So I switched to Lead, and now Lead and OpenWRT have kissed and made up. I've got to switch back to OpenWRT, I think, or something. I don't know. I don't like the idea of flashing routers, because as soon as I flash it, I basically break the internet for the house, as mm-hmm. I've mentioned previously. So I don't like touching it.
I haven't found Daniel's comment. Oh, right, good.
Daniel 666666, or maybe one less than that, said, I'm afraid Mark's mic could use with a bit of an audio upgrade. Sounds very muffled this time. That was last week's episode. So hopefully this time Mark sounds better. It's nothing to do with him having a cold or something. I don't know.
No. Okay. So Hamza tweeted us at Ubuntu Podcast.
I had at Ubuntu Podcast on in the car. 5-year-old said it makes him sleepy, so can I please play it for him every night at bedtime? He promptly fell asleep.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Brilliant. Johannes left a comment on our website for Season 11, Episode 6, 6 Feet Over It.
No idea why all these home internet gateways don't simply offer the option to act as a recursive DNS resolver for all devices on the inside, instead of just forwarding DNS requests to external servers. Those DNS servers hosted by your ISP or Google made sense in the times of home dial-up, but don't anymore. There's no need to run all your DNS traffic through some worldwide snooping service single point of failure, Google Cloudflare, etc., for worthless privacy promise.
That's a fair point. I mean, it's possible for your home router to do DNS properly, and I'm sure there are packages for my Lead, OpenWRT, DDWRT, whatever. I'm sure there are proper DNS servers that I could run internally. I don't know. Do you guys run DNS internally?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. Well, actually, I don't anymore. I used to. I used to have DNS mask running on my router, and that would handle the internal subnet and do the root DNS resolution and look up for everything outside. But these days I just use multicast DNS or Avahi on the LAN, so it's just hostname.local and it just automatically resolves everything. Right. I use that.
Yeah, I'm using DNS mask, and then I just have it use now I have it use 1.1.1.1 for anything which it doesn't already know, I suppose. I'm not sure if that's different to what Johannes is suggesting.
Yeah, you can actually have DNS on your LAN that goes out and looks at the root DNS servers for resolution.
Oh, right. Rather than having an interim. Okay. Yeah, got it.
So, Neil Batchelor also commented in response to our Dell XPS 13 review.
During the podcast, you mentioned a couple of utilities that help with optimizing battery life. Could you share a few more details? I caught one, PowerTop-Calibrate, but couldn't catch the details of the other.
Okay, so PowerTop, you need to apt install PowerTop, and that's a tool that enables you to see what the power draw is on the laptop, and as you adjust screen brightness, you'll see the power come down. And you can manually tweak the tunables, so you can change the power profile for USB devices and SATA devices and things of that nature. If you run PowerTop Calibrate whilst the laptop is obviously on, but not connected to the power supply, so just running on the battery, it runs for a few minutes, and it, rather worryingly, the screen will go off periods of time, but it will probe all of the power profiles that are available and calibrate a profile for your specific laptop. And then after you've done that, you're able to run PowerTop --AutoTune, which will automatically apply all of the relevant tunables to your laptop, so that when you're running on battery only, it's running in the most battery optimized way possible, and you can create a systemd unit to automatically do that PowerTop auto tune.
Awesome.
That's rather clever.
It's very useful, and it does save quite a considerable amount of battery as well. And John the Nice Guy Spriggs sent us some command line love, which has been safely deposited in our vault of love.
Awesome. Is that the end of the feedback?
That is. It says here that's the end of episode something something, but I'm pretty sure that's the end of episode 8.
You're going to be in Spain when this goes out, aren't you?
I am, yes. I can't wait. Yeah, I go out, yeah, timey-wimey, next week.
And then we're back the week after, and we should probably talk about the whatever the news coverage is of the 1804 release, because that will have been out for a few days. And
yes, there should be some feedback and reaction to that, so we'll have a look hopefully at the 1804 stuff. Yeah.
And if anyone has any feedback about 1804, if they've been using it or done the upgrade, let us know.
So thank you all for listening. You can reach us at Ubuntu Podcast on Twitter or join our Telegram group on ubuntupodcast.org/telegram. See you all next time.